Hi, everyone. Thanks for tuning in. It's our GRF On The Go podcast, and I'm Evgeny. I'm here with my co-host and my colleague, Trisha. And as always, we're glad to see you all.
We sure are. And so in this episode, we're going to be rebroadcasting one of our most recent webinars. We believe this topic is timely, practical, and something of value for you and your organization.
And that's right. And as always, if you have any questions after this webinar, feel free to reach out to us directly. You'll find our contact information in the show notes. And we always love to hear from our audience. And with that, let's get started.
Hello, everyone. I wanted to welcome everybody to participating in today's annual tax planning webinar. This is one of our most popular discussions each year, and we're glad to have you with us. My name is Julie Hulam, and I am a tax partner here at GRF. Today, we're joined by my colleague, Mark Sackis, and he is a senior manager in our for-profit tax group. The two of us have a wealth of knowledge and experience dealing with a new tax provision, so we have a lot of great stuff to share with you today. Participants who are seeking CPE credit today must complete and submit a short survey that will appear automatically following the webinar. To obtain CPE, please participate in each of the polling questions throughout the webinar. We will then be able to gauge your activity or your participation in our webinar. Please note that the webinar is not intended for financial or legal advice. It's simply for educational purposes. We are GRS CPAs and advisors. We're based out of Bethesda, Maryland, and we're serving the DMV, but we also have national and international clients. Our firm serves a wide range of clients covering non-for-profit, for-profit, schools, government contractors, and others. We have been in operations for several decades, and next year we will celebrate our 45th anniversary. Just a quick list of all the service offerings that we provide in the groups that we have here at GRF. We have a lot of exciting content to cover. The bill that was recently passed is huge. So without further ado, let's get into it. Let's start with reviewing a quick overview of the One Big Beautiful Bill, or OBBB for short. This legislation was one of the most significant tax overhauls since the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. It impacts nearly all categories of taxpayers. The primary purpose was to address the expiring TCJA provisions that were sunsetting at the end of 2025, as well as codify much of the Republican tax agenda for the long term. The Act also introduced several new key provisions that go beyond the TCJA framework. We'll start our discussion on the individual tax updates. I will be going into more detail discussing the permanent extensions from the TCJA, the state and local tax deduction, the charitable contribution limitations, other itemized deductions, standard deduction, talk about loan interest on auto loans, tipped income and overtime pay. Okay. The OBBB makes permanent many of the expiring TCJA provisions, including the individual tax bracket and lower rates, increase of the standard deduction, the elimination of personal exemption, which most didn't think was ever going to come back into play after it was temporarily eliminated in the TCJA. Enhanced child tax credit, the lower cap for the mortgage interest deduction, the disallowance of the miscellaneous itemized deduction. So think of, you know, legal fees, advisor fees, tax prep fees at the individual level, and the permanent AMT, higher AMT exemption. So we'll start with in more detail on the state and local or SALT deduction. The SALT cap has been a really highly contentious issue since it was introduced as such a strict limitation with the TCJA. It's seen as a punishment for many taxpayers in blue states. So the change was a major point of negotiation for lawmakers from the high tax states. Under the new OBBB, the SALT deduction has increased to $40,000 from the previous $10,000 limit. The high cap is temporary and will be phased out for taxpayers with modified AGI over $500,000. For every dollar over the threshold, the cap will be reduced by 30%. The cap is increased each year by 1% for tax years between 2026 and 2029. So there is there will be provided a small annual adjustment. But again, this cap is a temporary provision that is set to revert back to the $10,000 limit after tax year 2029. For taxpayers that have AGI in excess of $600,000, the entire benefit of the $40,000 will be eliminated and revert back to the $10,000, regardless of the annual increase. So what counts as SALT taxes that qualify for this itemized deduction? When we think about this, we want to consider state and local income taxes that are paid or general sales taxes that are also paid. You can pick one or the other, but not both. We're looking at state and local real estate property taxes and personal property taxes. These changes mean a higher potential deduction for many taxpayers. Now let's look at the charitable donations. Starting in 2026, a new AGI floor is going to be introduced. This means that charitable contributions must exceed 0.5% of your adjusted gross income to be deductible. If your total charitable deductions do not surpass this threshold, then you will not be able to receive the deduction for those contributions. This 0.5% floor applies to all types of charitable contributions, regardless of if you're paying cash, securities, other property, and regardless of recipient type, as long as it's a qualified charitable organization. Now let's review the charitable donation limitations. For cash contributions to regular qualified charities, the deduction is limited to 60% of AGI. The limit is now permanent, and any excess can be carried forward for up to 5 years. Non-cash contributions to qualified charities are limited to 30% of AGI. And for contributions to certain private foundations, the limit is 30% of AGI and for cash and 20% for non-cash. Again, excess can be carried forward, but they're subject to the same percentage limitations. These changes are designed to encourage larger charitable gifts while setting threshold and limits on the deductibility. But again, this is one thing that we'll discuss a little bit further on just about bunching your charitable gifts potentially into a single year. So one way to do that is the use of a donor advice fund. It's a great tool for planning purposes. Again, it's bunching deductions into a particular year. It can be set up by most retail brokerages. And so what you do is you have a large lump sum of a donation and you receive the donation in year one, but then you can spread out the giving to charities among multiple years. So it's you do need to think about, you know, in the next 3-5 years, what your plan contributions are expected to be, and think about if the deduction consolidated into the first year would make a meaningful impact on your tax liability. There is, you know, you can use donate stock or cash into the funds. A qualified charitable distribution is another option as a donation tool. It is a direct transfer from IRAs to a charity. Funds cannot pass through your hands or through another account. The taxpayer must be at least 70 and a half years old at the time of transfer to qualify. The distribution is not taxable to the taxpayer, but it's also not considered a charitable contribution, but it would satisfy the requirement for the required minimum distribution, or RDM. The maximum QCD amount is $108,000 per year. And this is actually a pretty significant increase, which was adjusted for inflation. So the QDC is an option that allows taxpayers to make significant charitable gifts directly from the IRAs. So I do want to pause here and just think about, from a planning perspective, you know, we'll often get a lot of questions are, should we make charitable contributions right now and getting ahead of the end of year? And I just want to note that it's not a one size fits all answer. It's best to look at multiple scenarios and model out how each can impact the taxpayer's tax liability. So for example, if there is a taxpayer that has $750,000 of income and is planning to donate $20,000 to charity in 2025, but in the long term is looking to donate $100,000, $20,000 each of the next 5 years, we would really want to model out how that would look like, you know, set the traditional $20,000 a year over the next 5 years. What would it look like if we did a donor advised fund in year one for $100,000, or splitting it into different amounts over the next 2 to 3 years? You know, you might lose some of the benefits because of some of the new limitations that are in place. So again, I don't want to say yes, definitely make that contribution right now for in this year, but I think it makes sense to have the discussion to say what makes the most sense. Let's talk about the different options and how it could look if we model it out in different ways. Let's look at the updated rules for the mortgage interest deduction, as well as the overall limitation for the itemized deduction. With the TCJA Act, the cap on interest deduction was reduced from $1 million down to $750,000 of indebtedness, meaning that if you have a mortgage in excess of those amounts, then your interest on that from an itemized deduction perspective does get limited. The OBBB made this a permanent provision. And so this was one that was, you know, potentially going to expire. And so now it has been made permanent. Now it does impact it's, or if your indebtedness incurred prior to 2017, the cap is still $1 million, but on a go forward basis, it's the $750,000. One of the interesting things that the OBB introduced was this new limitation on overall itemized deductions. And so this is going to be a little confusing. I promise I have an example coming up, but the total itemized deduction limitation is going to be limited to 2/37 of the lesser of the total itemized deduction or the taxable income in excess of the top tax bracket of 37% for the respective year. Introducing the new cap on the total value of itemized deduction, it's important to review your eligibility and the potential benefit you will receive under these new provisions. Again, it kind of goes back to looking out 5 years or so and which year does it make sense for certain planning opportunities. But, you know, I want taxpayers to be aware that you are now potentially limited by the amount of itemized deductions you can take.
Hey, Julie, just one quick, I guess, question or point of topic here. You know, we've kind of talked through the new state and local tax deduction limitation. We've talked through, you know, limitations for charitable donations deduction, the mortgage interest, you know, limitation on the deduction. And now there's kind of an introduction here of just overall itemized deductions. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, how these all connect together? What's the interplay here? And what should, you know, we all be thinking about as we do kind of our year-end planning for 2025 and going into 2026? It's a lot to kind of think about. So interested if you could expand a little bit on kind of how these limitations all work together.
Absolutely. Thanks, Mark. Good question. Because we do need to look at the type of the itemized deduction by bucket. And so first would be looking at the SALT cap and if there is a limiting that deduction at the state and local taxes. So, you know, do you receive the $40,000? You know, you might actually have less than 40,000, you know, anywhere in between. But if you are limited, first, let's look at that cap. Then we can move to the charitable contribution limitation and apply that based on AGI and type of gift to then look in total. So we first need to do by the each individual bucket. Then we look consolidating them together. And that's when we go into the total overall limitation calculation. I would say again that we need to be cognizant of, you know, the timing of these provisions, that some are starting in 25 and some are starting in 26. So again, it's a great time right now before year end to model out different scenarios if you're making any adjustments for and trying to get it in for 25, or does it make sense to push into 26 planning? Okay, so an example of this 2/37 calculation. So let's assume that we have a married filing joint taxpayer. Their taxable income is $900,000. Their itemized deductions before the limit is $100,000. So we've already gone through the whole process of checking to see if, you know, they're limited by the SALT cap of $40,000 with their taxable income, you would expect that they would be down to $10,000. So we've already gone through that. Now we're looking at the overall limit. So their total itemized deductions was $100,000. Again, this is before the limit of the overall, the 37% tax bracket. So first we need to add back the itemized deduction for the limitation purposes. So now we're back up to $1 million of income. The 37% tax bracket threshold is $751,600. So we take the total taxable income less that amount. The $248,400 is the first amount that we're comparing between the lesser of. So that's our first, the bracket threshold. Then let's see if we're looking at the total itemized deduction. So our total itemized deductions are less than the bracket threshold. So now we're going to take the 2/37 of the $100,000 of itemized deductions. So when we calculate that, that's looking at about $5,400. And so what happens is we take our $100,000 of itemized deductions, we reduce it by this limit of $54,505. So our new itemized deduction that we are allowed to deduct after this limitation is $94,595. So again, I know it's a little bit complicated, but it is showing that there is going to be an impact coming in 2026 on the total itemized deductions you want to take or are able to take. Okay, moving on to a new standard deduction for seniors. So I know when the whole reconciliation process was going through, there was a lot of discussion of if there was going to be a no tax on Social Security. And there was a lot of misinformation going out there, whether it be on social media or elsewhere. But no tax on Social Security was not part of the bill. So instead, an additional $6,000 deduction was added for taxpayers over 65 years of age. And this is a nice benefit because this is whether you itemize or use the standard deduction. So it really is for, you know, all senior taxpayers that qualify. It also is a per taxpayer deduction. So married filing jointly could receive $12,000 deduction, assuming both qualify for the age requirement. It does phase out if your gross income is over $75,000. So I'm not sure we would see it a ton just from a limitation on the income, but we definitely want to make sure that people are aware of this. You know, I could see a lot of older taxpayers that are on fixed income being able to utilize this deduction. Okay. As I previously said, the standard deduction increase was made permanent with the bill. So for tax year 2025, there is a $31,500 standard deduction for married filing jointly, $23,625 for head of household, and $15,750 for single taxpayers or married filing separately. You know, with the TCJA, we really did see a spike in the amount of people that were using the standard deduction over the itemized deduction. With these increased deduction amounts, I would expect the trend to continue. But it will be interesting to see how the SALT cap increase to $40,000 does allow more people that have been previously using the standard deduction with the new TCJ or with the old TCJA provisions are now able to itemize given that the state and local tax has increased, especially in the DMV area where, you know, we have really high property taxes, high state taxes, et cetera. One other thing that was a nice benefit that was added to the bill is for non-itemizers, you are able to deduct up to $1,000 for single of charitable gifts and $2,000 for married filing jointly made to charitable organizations. I think that with the increase in standard deduction and people utilizing that, a lot of the gift giving that people were doing, you know, as a form of tax planning really decreased. And so this is another opportunity to, you know, encourage gifts to charity. Just checking on time, I think we're doing okay, but I will go through a couple of these a little quicker. The bill did add an additional deduction on tipped income. So up to $25,000 of tipped income can be excluded from the individual's income. This again phases out after you reach a certain threshold of income. And for this item, it's for $150,000. The additional deduction for car loan interest. So this is a nice little benefit that you can deduct up to $10,000 on your auto loan interest that has been paid. Again, it's kind of a lower phase out limit of $100,000. This needs to be on new cars. So used car purchases do not qualify. And another important fact is that the final assembly has to be in the United States to qualify for the deduction. There's no tax on overtime pay, and this annual deduction is up to $12,500. Again, we're looking at $150,000 as the AGI threshold phase out. I guess for $300,000 for married filing joint. Okay, a couple other quick things. The child tax credit has been permanently increased to $2,200 per child. I know that this was a lot, there was a lot of back and forth on the amount for the child tax credit. So it did increase from the previous years. Again, we're seeing phase outs of from an AGI amount, but these are much higher than some of the tipped income and the overtime pay. So at $400,000, married filing jointly starts to phase out. Okay, the alternative minimum tax. And so I bet most people thought that this almost went away because of the increase in the exemption. Not many people triggered AMT for the last couple of years. The exemption has also been made permanent. And what's nice about this is that you have to have a gross income or AGI of over $1.2 million for married filing jointly to start triggering AMT. So it is a very high threshold to actually come back in and you know, be required to pay that additional tax. Okay, so obviously there is a lot of planning opportunities ahead of us for 25 with all of the new provisions and how that's going to impact, you know, giving and structuring and things like that. And of course, Mark's going to go in on detail in the business provisions, but just a couple other ways to think about reducing your taxes. Max out your 401k. The increase for inflation is $23,500 for 2025. You know, always, if possible, hold investments for at least a year to trigger the long-term capital gain rate versus a short-term rate. If you have a lot of capital gains and you're able to harvest some losses in a separate sale transactions, that's a way to reduce your capital gains in total. Similar to thinking about bucketing and bunching all of your charitable donations into a single year, if there's a way to bunch medical expenses to accelerate those expenses to get over the 7.5 AGI threshold, that's an opportunity to consider contributing to an IRA, converting to a Roth. You know, the Roth conversion has been pretty popular in recent years. And, you know, don't miss out on letting tax advisors know, you know, all of your child expenses, you get claiming the child care credit, claiming any education credits with 529 plans. You know, sometimes we just don't know what has happened. So just remembering all of the things that you've done and donated throughout the year. Quickly just show what the tax rates look like for 2025. Again, that the max rate of 37% triggered at $751,000 for married filing jointly at the max rate. Capital gain rates and brackets. Again, this is different based on the type of income you have. So our capital gains are treated differently and taxed at a different rate. A quick little summary of what we have discussed from the individual side. One thing I do want to mention is to be cognizant of what we call bracket creep. You know, with inflation, a lot of people's salaries have increased and they are getting pushed into a higher tax bracket, even though their purchasing power has not necessarily increased with that. So, you know, part of our planning strategy is to make sure you're not hit with some, you know, bracket creep hidden tax and seeing if we can make sure you stay in a lower bracket and not be pushed into that higher bracket. So there's a lot of planning opportunities available, modeling out different scenarios as we previously discussed. But hopefully that is all helpful from the individual side. So with that, polling question number one, we'll give everybody 30 seconds to a minute to answer. For tax year 2026, what is the AGI floor for charitable donations? A is 5%, B is 7.5%, C is 0.5%, or there is no AGI floor. The correct answer is C, 0.5%. 61% of listeners got that right. Great job, guys. Okay, and with that, I'll let Mark continue the discussion on business taxes.
Awesome. Thank you, Julie. Good morning, everyone. Afternoon, wherever you are joining us today. We have a ton of material to get through here, the second half of this presentation. So we're going to have to kind of go a little quick. Again, I think there's quite a lot of topics, a lot of updates that kind of came through the OBBB this summer. So we're going to kind of, you know, like I said, dive through here. First is our kind of business tax updates. And here's our quick agenda regarding first starting with research and experimental costs under Section 174. We'll talk through bonus depreciation and Section 179 deductions. revisit qualified business income and the allowable deduction related to that, excess business loss limitations, state pass-through entity taxes, business interest deduction, and then qualified small business stock. Just a quick update on that one too. Hopefully a little bit less math than Julie's section here, but we got a lot to jump into. So first section, research and experimental costs under IRC section 174. We'll kind of use these terms interchangeably a little bit, research and experimental, research and development costs, either section 174, IRS section 174, things along those lines. Research and experimental costs and research and development costs are very similar. There is a little bit of a deviation in terms of the costs that get caught up in section 174 versus the costs that are allowable as a tax credit for a research and development tax credit. But again, for our purposes today, we're going to kind of use those terms interchangeably. So I guess to start off, you know, what are these costs? Generally speaking and broadly defined, you know, these are costs for the development or improvement of a product or process that are intended to eliminate uncertainty. Key to highlight, I think, with this one is that you don't necessarily need to be developing a new product. You don't need to be developing a new widget or whatever it is that's a physical good. These costs also fall into the category of process improvements. So if you are undertaking some development costs or research costs that are intended to, you know, make things more efficient or improve the processes that are in place, generally speaking, those costs would be included under the IRC section 174 research and experimental costs. Previously, before the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, taxpayers had the option to either immediately expense in the year incurred or capitalize and amortize these research and experimental costs. For domestic our research and experimental costs, those were capitalized and amortized over a five-year period. For non-US costs, those were capitalized and amortized over a 15-year period. The Tax Cuts and Jobs Act changed this and disallowed the option to immediately expense in the year incurred these research and experimental costs. Those were phased in over time. So starting with the 2022 tax year, all costs, regardless of domestic or international costs, were required to be capitalized and amortized. That phased in, like I said, for the 2022 tax period. The One Big Beautiful Bill passed over the summer has now changed this, and domestic costs are now able to be expensed immediately in the year that are incurred. There is still the option to capitalize and amortize these costs over a five-year period if the taxpayer desires, but is no longer required capitalization and amortization of domestic costs. Note that non-domestic U.S. expenses or non-domestic expenses continue to be required to be capitalized and amortized over a 15-year period. This change is effective for tax years beginning after December 31st, 2024, so starting with the 2025 tax period. Important to note again that software development costs continue to be classified as Section 174. So anything related to software development, software implementation, things along those lines do fall under the category for Section 174 costs. Now, it is important to note too that the Section 174 requirements apply to both direct and indirect costs. So if you are paying a third party to undertake these research and experimental costs on your behalf, those costs still would qualify for the Section 174. And continue to going forward, if those are non-US expenses, those would be required to be capitalized and amortized over a 15-year period. So good news, I think, from a taxpayer perspective. This was one area that I think had pretty broad bipartisan support to go back and correct. The application of the research and experimental costs affected many different taxpayers. As I said, it's a very broad kind of definition. And so this was not, you know, limited to one industry or one type of taxpayer. So this, I think, was a very welcome change for a lot of different taxpayers. So again, good news from a taxpayer perspective, we now have the option to elect to immediately expense in the year incurred those domestic research and experimental costs. But the question remains, what do we do about costs that were already capitalized and amortized over the 5 or 15 year period? This bill gives two options to claim relief from those capitalized costs that were previously reported on 2022, 2023, and 2024 tax years. One of those is a retroactive relief, meaning you can go back to tax years 2022, 2023, and 2024, and you can claim retroactive relief via amended returns. The other option is to treat this on a prospective basis, meaning you can deduct the unamortized costs in a future tax period. The retroactive relief is available only for certain small businesses as defined by the IRS. Generally speaking, small businesses are classified via a gross receipts test. And if the average gross receipts for your business for the past 3 tax periods exceeds $31 million, then you are generally classified as a large business and you do not have the option to go back and claim retroactive relief for these Section 174 costs. On a prospective basis, you have two options for how you'd like to treat the unamortized Section 174 costs. You can either deduct the entire unamortized costs in the 2025 tax period, or you can elect to ratably deduct the unamortized costs over the 2025 and 2026 tax periods. So to summarize, there is a retroactive relief, which is only available for small business taxpayers, or there is prospective relief, which is only available for large taxpayers, or a small business may elect to either claim retroactive relief or a prospective relief, either over the 2025 or 2026 tax periods.
Mark, I do have a question for you. You mentioned that the requirement to capitalize R&D or R&E cost under TCJA impacted a lot of taxpayers. So would you recommend businesses go immediately amend if they qualify or elect out or elect to do the catch up in starting in 2025?
Yeah, I'm going to give you a very accountant answer and say that it depends. It depends. There's a lot of considerations that need to be taken into account here. So I think, you know, generally speaking, cash flow considerations, business considerations, et cetera. If you're a small taxpayer and you can elect to go back and claim retroactive relief, you need to do this via amended returns. So that's an additional compliance cost that needs to be undertaken with your service provider. You know, it's additional kind of processing times, administrative, you know, requirements to go back and actually file the returns. The timing on it could stretch, you know, a year or more in terms of when you actually get the cash for your refunds. So it all kind of depends, I think, in terms of the situation. There's no real one size fits all kind of answer to this. There's a point on here about flow through businesses, right? If you are a business that's operating in, you know, obviously you have your federal filing and then maybe one other jurisdiction, you know, two amended returns is something that's a little bit more palatable to handle. Now, if you have a partnership or an S corporation that has, you know, 10 to 15 different partners, members, shareholders, et cetera, that's operating in 25 to 30 states, then the administrative burden starts to add up very, very quickly. So it kind of depends. Like I said, it's not something that we can just sit here and say, yes, you should go back and amend, or yes, you should go forward and do this on a prospective basis. There's a lot that comes into consideration with this. You know, cost, time, administrative burden, things along those lines, and just kind of where you are within your situation as well, right? You know, we could say, yeah, it's a big hassle to kind of go back and amend. But if you know that in 2025, 2026, 2027, that you're going to have tax losses and you're not going to be able to utilize the benefit of these, you know, unamortized deductions anyway, then maybe it does make sense to go back. So it's just one of those things where you kind of have to spend a little time, work with your service provider, do some modeling and kind of work through those different scenarios too. So As I said, you can kind of go back if you meet those certain thresholds, or we could, like Julie mentioned, make the adjustment in 2025 and 2026. We could have been a taxpayer back in those kind of old years. If you have taxable income projected for the 2025 and 2026 periods, maybe we elect to take those deductions in 25 and 26, decrease our taxable income, decrease the amount of cash that we need to pay out for either estimated payments, extension payments, things along those lines. So it could be that, you know, that's a more favorable situation to you, and you can realize faster cash savings using that method as opposed to kind of going back and doing amended returns. So again, it's not an easy answer, and there's a lot to kind of consider when going through all this analysis. Final point on this is just interaction with other provisions. So we'll mention it here shortly, but you know, the international provisions for multinationals of BEAT, FDII, business interest expense deductions, et cetera, there's all limitations regarding these provisions as well. And so these all need to kind of be done together when you're doing this kind of analysis. Depreciation and cost recovery. So bonus depreciation has been starting to phase out over the last handful of years. There was 100% deduction for tax purposes for these qualifying assets. It started to phase out. It was at 60% for the 2024 tax period, scheduled to go to 40% for the 2025, and then down to zero starting in the 2027 tax period. The OBBB has restored the 100% bonus depreciation expensing. So this applies to property with 3, 5, 7, 10, 15, and 20-year life classifications. So very, very beneficial. And I think very well received for the taxpayer, and provides a lot of opportunities for immediate deduction for some of these new fixed assets and equipment and stuff purchased. Section 179 also received a pretty significant bump as part of the OBBB. So for 2025, the taxpayers can now expense up to $2.5 million of qualifying property. This deduction is starting to phase out once the business places over $4 million of property in service during the tax period. This is a significant increase over the prior rules for Section 179 before passage of the reconciliation bill this summer. And just quick note here, Section 179 cannot create or increase a loss. That's not the same case for bonus depreciation. Bonus depreciation can create an increase of loss. So just keep that in mind when you're thinking about, you know, potential purchases and whether 179 or bonus depreciation makes sense. And then just also quick note on state adjustments that many states have decoupled from bonus depreciation and Section 179. And so there are state considerations with these accelerated cost recovery methods as well. Quick mention here of qualified production property. So this is a new provision from the OBBB. This is for US-based non-residential real property. So if there is real property that is an integral part of qualified production activities, which is activities including manufacturing, production, refining of tangible personal property, this is now eligible for 100% expensing on qualifying property. So immediate expensing opportunities for real property here in the US, which is a very new and potentially significantly beneficial for these taxpayers who are kind of meeting these requirements. This is applicable for projects that begin construction after January 19th, 2025, and then placed in service prior to January 1, 2031. Quick summary here of bonus depreciation and Section 179 rules. So again, 2024 pre-OBBB, the bonus depreciation rate was dropping down to 60%, scheduled to phase out to 40% for 25. That's now been restored to 100% for 2025 and going forward. You can see the Section 179 limits, it was $1.2 million on $3 million of purchases pre-OBBB. That's been bumped up to $2.5 million deduction on $4 million before the phase out hits post-OBBB. Again, real property, introduction of the qualified production property classification, which is now available for 100% expensing. And then also quick note on the transition rules. So the acquisition date, meaning the date that a binding contract was entered, is going to determine the eligibility for 100% bonus depreciation, the accelerated Section 179 limits. It is not the date that this property is placed in service. It's the date that the contract was entered into to acquire these to acquire the property. Qualified business income. Quick note here, just to say that the Section 170 or Section 199 Cap A qualified business income deduction has now been extended. So this allows small business owners and self-employed individuals to deduct up to 20% of their qualified business income on their individual returns. So this is true for sole proprietors, partnership, LLC, S-corps, rental income, et cetera. Again, up to 20% of your qualified business income can be deducted from your taxable income. Important to note here that the specified service trader business designation continues to apply. So for any trader business involving the performance of services in the fields of health, accounting, performing arts, consulting, law, actuarial services, athletes, financial services, and brokerages, the 20% deduction is limited when your AGI hits these certain thresholds, which are indexed now for inflation. For the 2025 tax period, that's $394,600 when the phase-in starts to kick in, and then fully phased out once you hit $494,600 of taxable income. So very beneficial. This was kind of on the table, but again, I think most people agreed that this is something that was going to continue on, and it has in a permanent capacity. This here is just subject to limitations for the deduction, but we don't need to spend a lot of time on this. And then again, just more considerations when you're kind of going through year end planning to how make sure that you're kind of maximizing this qualified business income deduction. Excess business loss limitation rules. This has now been extended as well. For the 2026 tax year, business losses that are kind of flowed through to the individual 1040 are going to be limited to $500,000 for married filing joint returns and then $250,000 for all other returns. These are going to be indexed for inflation going forward. Any losses that are limited due to the excess business loss limitation rules are essentially reclassified as net operating losses, which will be carried forward to future tax periods and subject to the same limitations that net operating losses would be subject to. State past due entity taxes. This again has been extended. Julie talked through, you know, the now enacted $40,000 SALT limit. The same kind of rules apply. 36 states and New York City have enacted legislation for past due entity taxes. This essentially allows a deduction at the business entity level for these pass-through entity taxes that are paid. And then the owners who elect into the pass-through entity program are allowed a credit on their individual returns when they go to file at these states in the state jurisdictions. Again, this is just, initially enacted after the TCJA limitation for the state and local tax deduction, and it continues to apply and will still apply regardless of the, you know, kind of enhanced $40,000 SALT limit. And again, this is kind of going forward as well. Business interest deduction. So the deduction for business interest under IRC Section 163J is now changing for the 2026 tax period. So you're essentially allowed a deduction up to 30% of your adjusted taxable income for any interest expense that's incurred from the business. This was adjusted so that the calculation for adjusted taxable income was done on an EBIT basis, where it's disregarded depreciation and amortization. This is now changed for the 2026 tax period. Let me flip back. There we go. Thank you. So this is now flipped back for the 2026 tax period, in that the, I guess, more taxpayer-friendly EBITDA calculation when you're doing your 30% of adjusted taxable income for the deduction for business interest. And again, this is, you know, I mentioned this when we were talking about the Section 174, you know, do we decide to take all of the expenses in 2025, or do we spread this out over 2025 and 2026? You know, the EBIT calculation is applicable for the 2025 tax period, but the EBITDA calculation is kind of back in place for the 2026 tax period. So if you have material business interest expense in your entity, It may not be as beneficial to take all of those 174 amortization costs in 2025, push some of those into 2026, so that you get the more kind of friendly EBITDA calculation for your business interest deduction. Quick note on U.S. multinational corporations. So many of the international provisions enacted via the TCJA were now made permanent. GILTI, FIDI, and BEATS, which are newly renamed the NCTI, FDDEI, and then BEATS, though, provisions have been extended with the OBBB. And then there's some minor policy changes in terms of the tax rates and then applicable exemptions, et cetera. But in general, these provisions continue. Quick note here that there was a successful negotiation of kind of the minimum standards for the U.S. tax law regarding the OECD Pillar 2 minimum tax rules. So beneficial, I think, for the U.S. and multinational corporations that these rules now kind of meet the minimum standards for the OECD Pillar 2. Just quick, you know, summary here, based on our timing here, we can go ahead and skip through this. And I think polling question number two is going to be next. So we'll give a minute or two for that. What is the maximum deduction available for qualified business income? A, 20%, B, 25%, and C, 50%. A, 20% is correct. Okay, real quick, seeing as we're coming up on time here, 2025 other tax updates that we wanted to make sure that we mentioned as part of this discussion as well. Estates and trusts, so the federal lifetime estate gift and generation skipping exclusion amounts has increased for 2025 up to $13,990,000 for per individual. So almost up to $28 million for a married couple. For 2026, it's going to jump up to $15 million for individual and then $30 million for married couples starting, like I said, for the 26 tax year. And then the exemptions are going to be indexed to inflation starting with the 2027 tax year. So I think that was also one that was pretty widely expected to be extended under the OBBB this summer. Also, a quick note on the annual gift tax exclusion for 2025 tax year, that is $19,000 per recipient. More kind of considerations with estate and trust taxes. RMD is up to 73 now. Also consider state estate tax implications. I know Maryland and DC both have their own separate kind of estate taxes. And then inheritance taxes is also one to keep an eye on as well. Not new from this summer's OBBB, but the elimination of the stretch IRA, that now has to be fully paid out within 10 years of the date of the death of the original account holder. Again, not new for 2025 going forward, but just something to keep in mind as we're working through those considerations. Quick slide here on federal estate tax brackets. The 40% top rate kicks in at over $1 million. Again, with a $15 million lifetime exemption per individual starting with 2026 tax period. Tax alert. So there was an executive order that was sent out earlier this year that directed the Treasury Department to stop issuing paper checks for all federal disbursements. This is all kind of federal benefits. And unfortunately, the IRS is included with this. So starting as effective September 30th, 2025, all tax refunds will no longer be processed via paper checks. Everything needs to be done electronically, either direct deposit or some sort of electronic or digital payment. There are kind of certain stipulations that were very unclear, and no guidance has really been issued yet in terms of those individuals or entities that are lacking access to digital payment systems. But this is something that definitely to keep an eye on going forward. I know that the disbursements directive was effective September 30th, 2025. So that's all payments from the U.S. Treasury. They are still working towards accepting paper checks to also be phased out going forward. So if you are still writing checks to the IRS, sending them in the mail, this is something that we'll need to look into setting up some sort of electronic payment options, as this is kind of a big change for the way that things have kind of operated so far. Quick note for our DMV individuals, Maryland has introduced a new tech tax. So this is just an essentially a expansion of what qualifies for sales and use tax. And it's now, it's expanded the definition to basically kind of technology type services. So cloud computing, web hosting, data processing, software publishing, computer designs, things along those lines. They have now expanded the definition for what a taxable service is. And these taxable services do now qualify for a sales and use tax. So if you're in this realm, this is something that I think we're kind of starting to see is maybe we'll call them non-income taxes that are being certainly pushed out in different jurisdictions. And Maryland in particular has now enacted one over the summer for a 3% sales tax on those kind of data and IT services. So definitely one to keep an eye on for DMV residents and just kind of in general going forward. Standard cost of living adjustments here, 401k, 403b limits, up to $23,500 plus $7,500 for over age 50. Social Security wage limit for 2025 is $176,100. And then like we talked about, the QBI deduction income phase out is at $394,600 for joint filers. And then that is expected to be indexed for inflation kind of going forward as well. Other tax laws, like you said, with the RMDs, Julie talked about dependent care credits. So we will continue on through this. Net operating losses for 2025. So these are still subject to an 80% limitation. So even if you have net operating losses carried forward that sufficiently cover your taxable income for the period, if those losses were generated after the 2017 tax year, those losses are subject to an 80% limitation on your taxable income for the year. So you could very well have tax due, even if you have tax loss carry forwards, even if you have tax loss carries forward from a previous year. Just a quick note on, for DMV residents on changes to Maryland kind of taxes. I mentioned the new tech tax, we'll call it, changes to their tax brackets as well. And then one quick note too on capital gains. So Maryland has increased a 2% surcharge on capital gains for any kind of taxpayer that has federal adjusted gross income over $350,000. So again, that is new. That's not just a change in the tax rate. That's an actual change to a tax surcharge on capital gains that has not really been seen before. So keep an eye on that. And with that, we have made it to our final polling question right on time here. Question here is, how much is the annual gift tax exclusion limit for 2025? A, 5,000, B, 19,000, C, 13,990,000, or D, there is no limit. Correct answer is B, 19,000.
With that, we'd like to thank everyone for attending today's discussion. We encourage you all to follow us on social media and visit our website for upcoming events and alerts. Please remember to complete the survey that will appear after the session if you'd like to receive the CPE credit. We thank everybody again for joining and hope you all have a great day.
Well, thanks so much, everyone, for tuning in today. We hope that you found the information actionable and helpful.
And don't forget, you can always reach out to us if you'd like to continue this conversation. And maybe most importantly, don't forget to subscribe so that you don't miss our future episodes. Thanks as always for joining us, and we'll see you soon next time.
Click the link and follow.